It's a Narnia story that doesn't take place in Narnia, and I love that.
It's weird. It's a little disorienting when you first start.
You're listening to the podcast for those who have looked beyond the edge of the world.
And can't stop talking about it.
Welcome to Talking Beasts.
From NarniaWeb.com.
Where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis.
And keep a watchful eye.
On the latest Narnia movie news,
this
is Talking Beasts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm Rillian.
And I'm Glumpuddle.
And it's good to finally start our actual discussion of The Horse and His Boy.
It's about time. How many years have we been doing podcasts and just have mentioned this one in passing?
2005 is when we started doing the podcast. And it's kind of surprising it's taken us this long to actually continue working through all the books. We've only done a few.
In our most recent poll, The Horse, when we asked back in July, about once a year, we pull Narnia Webbers for their favorite Narnia mm-hmm. book. And in our most recent poll, The Horse and His Boy won with 24% of the vote. It was followed by The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe with 18%.
It's because everyone at Narnia Web understands the value of publication order.
Yes. I mean, if you're listening and you don't, thank you for listening and we're glad to have you.
But yes, indeed.
We respectfully.
It's okay. No one is perfect. It's okay. You know, it's all gonna be just fine. We're very welcoming.
I think even Horse and His Boy is better in publication order. And I'll explain why, I suspect, over the course of this conversation.
Indeed. And before we get started, Glumpuddle, you have a couple announcements.
Well, a couple quick things. So first off, we started the Talking Beast Facebook group, and it's been pretty cool to see. A lot of people joined very quickly, and I'm really looking forward to the more two-way discussion with listeners and getting ideas for topics and such. And a quick shout-out to who might be our youngest listener. Sarah claims that her 3-year-old son, Sam... Hi, Sam. How are you doing, Sam? Just a quick shout-out.
Hello.
So they listen together and eat popcorn. Yeah, and just listen to us talk. That's how they choose to pass the time. Okay, I guess I'm glad there are people...
Again, no one is perfect.
Yeah. That's how they choose to pass their time. So Sam, I should warn you, you're only 3 years old, so I'm assuming you haven't read The Horse and His Boy. There will be spoilers in the discussion to follow. So maybe your mom, Sarah, can cover your ears. I don't know, but just be aware of that.
And my son's not exactly in the running because despite him contributing to the last episode, he does not subscribe, nor does he download, nor does he even.
But he listens at least to your side of it. He often hears your side of it before anybody
else.
Yes,
he really loves the Rillian side of the discussion. He could not care less about the Glumpuddle side of the discussion. That's just, you know.
So there's that. Anyway, Talking Beast.
There's that. And to start the teaser for you to mull over, because this is actually, it's very important that Glumpuddle have time to consider stump a Narnia Webber question.
Really quick, I want to mention I also want to mention before we get started the Horse and His Boy stage play. The timing of this discussion, you know, we decided to do this, and now the Logos Theater has announced that they're doing a stage play version of The Horse and His Boy.
Glumpuddle's really excited about
this. I'm crazy excited about this.
Come with us to the desert, to the mountains, to Narnia and the North. The Logos Theater proudly presents its next C.S. Lewis classic adventure.
I mean, I've been really excited about the Prince Caspian stage play they did, which I saw and adored. And I felt a little bit uneasy sometimes about posting. I mean, I posted so much Prince Caspian stuff they've done because I love it. It's the best Prince Caspian adaptation that's been done. But a little uneasily just because, you know, obviously 99% of our readers and listeners can't make the trip to South Carolina to see the play. But The Horse and His Boy is going to be getting a DVD release, which means I can totally go crazy promoting it on Narnia Web because it's a thing that you can actually obviously going to the theater is which I'm going to do opening night is the way to do it. But the fact that everyone will be able to get a DVD is awesome. And I just wanted to mention it because we're starting Horse and His Boy discussion today and I'm kind of crazy excited about it.
Indeed.
And just had to mention that. And the Prince Caspian play is still ongoing. And if you buy tickets and enter the coupon code IFOUNDASLAN, you'll get a Narni Weber discount.
How much is that worth?
25%, I think.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Impressive.
Yeah.
Most impressive.
We'll discuss The Last Jedi later.
I'm going to give you some time to think about the Stump and Narni Weber question.
Okay. Give it to me now, and I'll give you my answer later. I know this one was submitted by Riotian because I forgot to plug Stump and Narni Weber last week. So let me just rectify that right now really quick. If you have a trivia question, please email it to, if you think you can stump a Narni Weber, email podcast@narniweb.com with stump in the subject.
But Riotian's question is, which of the following descriptions was used to describe the leaves from the toffee tree in The Magician's Nephew? A, crimson. B, papery. C, shimmering. Or D, smooth.
Interesting. I have a hunch, but I will wait until the end of the episode.
Again, nobody's perfect. No shame. And so to get started on the horse and his boy discussion, we're going to be introduced by the Narnia Nana.
Hello, this is Narnia Nana with another Narnia Nugget. I will be reading an excerpt from Chapter 3 of The Silver Chair. Jill and Eustace have just arrived at Cair Paravel. Supper in the great hall of the castle was the most splendid thing either of them had ever seen. For though Eustace had been in that world before, he had spent his whole visit at sea and knew nothing of the glory and courtesy of the Narnians at home in their own land. The banners hung from the roof, and each course came in with trumpeters and kettle drums. There were soups that would make your mouth water to think of, and the lovely fishes called pavanders, and venison and peacock and pies and ices and jellies and fruit and nuts and all manner of wines and fruit drinks. Even Eustace cheered up and admitted that it was something like. And when all the serious eating and drinking were over, a blind poet came forward and struck up the grand old tale of Prince Kor and Erebus and the horse Bree, which is called The Horse and His Boy, and tells of an adventure that happened in Narnia and Calormen and the lands between, in the golden age when Peter was high king in Cair Paravel. I haven't time to tell it now, though it is well worth hearing. When they were dragging themselves upstairs to bed, yawning their heads off, Jill said, "I bet we sleep well tonight." For it had been a full day, which just shows how little anyone knows what is going to happen to them next.
That's one of my favorite little moments for the kind of subtle narrator of the Chronicles at the very end there.
And, you know, one of these things, this is actually, The Horse and His Boy is really its own little Narnia nugget. See what I did there?
I see what you did there. Yeah.
Because I love this, because Narnia is this big world, and I even love the title The Chronicles of Narnia, because basically it's, here's this world, and we just have a few history books that are going to tell just some of the stories, and oh, we'll reference when the Lone Islands were first taken, and oh, we're going to reference Prince Kor and Erebus,
Moonwood and the Hare, and the
last battle. Maybe someday you'll hear one of these stories, and then bada bing, bada boom, we have The Horse and His Boy.
And it makes it feel, yeah, The Horse and His Boy being, like, there was all these, like, sort of little hints and teases he doesn't really deliver on because he doesn't have time. You know, that there's the idea this is a real world with a million stories. We're just getting seven of them. And I think the fact that we're getting one right now who'll flesh out makes the other ones go, well, I bet you the other ones are just as compelling and detailed, if not more compelling. And it makes the world feel, even though, you know, Lord Narnia doesn't have obviously nearly as elaborate of a mythology as, say, Lord of the Rings. To me, Narnia feels more real because of constantly feeling like there's something around the corner that I just can't see. And a lot of my favorite science fiction fantasy do that. Blade Runner is one of my favorite science fiction movies because...
It really is.
Yeah, because it just feels like, and I enjoyed the sequel, it feels like, wow, that room or that building over there, if I walked in there, there'd be something going on. The world feels bigger than what's on the screen. And so I think that's why, despite, you know, not having... as much world depth as maybe Lord of the Rings, it it feels so real, and it connects with me so much.
And I love that about The Horse and His Boy, because I feel like The Horse and His Boy gives so much depth to, because a lot of these are kind of road trip stories to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Last Battle to a much lesser extent. But even Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to a slightly less extent compared to, say, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader or The Silver Chair or The Horse and His Boy. And I love the vast variety and landscape in The Horse and His Boy and all the different locations. And yeah. I love that it opens up on the young boy Shasta, and it's not even in Narnia. It's a Narnia story that doesn't take place in Narnia, and I love that.
It's weird. It's a little disorienting when you first start, especially if you're reading in publication order, because we've done Wardrobe and Caspian with the Pevensies, then in Dawn Treader, we get Eustace introduced. We still got two Pevensies there. Then mm-hmm. Eustace carries over to the Silver Chair, and then all of a sudden, we go backwards in time to where miles and miles away from Narnia or anything that feels mm-hmm. familiar. And it's all just kind of out of nowhere. And it takes you a while to kind of get your head around, like, whoa, when I finished The Silver Chair and picked up Horse and His Boy, this wasn't what I was expecting. Where am I? Which is really perfect for the tone of the story and kind of what the theme of the story is. And so that's that feeling of unbelonging, that feeling of, mm-hmm. wait a minute, where am I, is greatly enhanced, I think, by reading it as book five. If you read it in chronological yeah. order as book three, and you just came out of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is about the time The Horse and His Boy takes place, you don't get that experience nearly as much.
And let me ask you something, because I'm even just thinking about this. I can't think of a book series that does introductions to the same world so many times. Like, it's a new introduction through the eyes of a new character.
Shasta,
I mean,
yeah.
You get little bits of that, but you have Lucy, her eyes, oh my goodness, here's the world of Narnia. You have Caspian, who was born in Narnia, but still gets that introduction from
that experience of discovering old Narnia and the talking animals.
Basically, yeah. You have Caspian, you have Eustace, you have Jill, especially in the Silver Chair, and now we have Shasta. What do you think that Shasta, his perspective, brings to the world of Narnia? If we're going to call it the world of Narnia, I don't even know what to really say, because it's not Middle Earth. It's not the country of Narnia, but it's the world of Narnia.
Right, yeah. And obviously he's been stuck in an old fisherman's hut his entire life. And so just like him, when he's encountering new things, it's new to us mm-hmm. as well. There's characters like Erebus and even Hwin, and of course Bree, who it's not all that new to them. They're kind of familiar with it, but Shasta, it's completely something else entirely. I love the descriptions when he first, the next day after he's left the fisherman's hut, and he talks about the air, it feels so clear, and it doesn't have the smell of fish anymore. He'd never been away from that smell before in his mm-hmm. life. And so although we're disoriented and feel out of place, I mean, Shasta, our main character Shasta, does too. So that makes us kind of want to connect with him.
I love how his, to a certain extent, he's one of the more foreign type of characters, in that you're trying to relate to him basically living life as a slave.
Mm-hmm.
He finds out that Arshish is going to sell him, and I guess I'm not really surprised. In fact, he almost feels good about the conversation. You know,
yeah.
I am not your father.
Can that line be in the movie? I am not your father.
But yes!
Yes!
But I mean, seriously, you know, it's such, in many ways, he's one of the more foreign type of characters. But he's instantly likable, at least for me. I really like the character of Shasta. And on one hand, I relate to him in that I, you know, really like it, the character, and I like viewing the world of Narnia through his eyes. But he's so different in that, in his perspective, that I just think, you know, of course, if I were in his circumstances, you know, like, oh, it's not my father, and oh, he's going to sell me. Oh, well, that's not be a sign of relief for me.
Lewis actually says, now you mustn't imagine that Shasta would feel as you or I would feel if we had just overheard us talking about our parents selling us into slavery. And Lewis feels the need to explain why it's different in this case. I definitely relate to the aspect of Shasta where I think this is the key line of the entire book, when the book talks about when Shasta would often gaze to the north and say, oh, my father, what is there beyond that hill? And I have always, almost every night, I look up at the sky and just think, because it's my fantasy, my dream, to one day visit other planets somehow. I just get so I'm obsessed with footage of Mars and the moon and space travel. And the idea of visiting, touching something that is another world, I just can't. That gets me excited beyond
Elon Musk. If you're one of our regular listeners, you know, we have a volunteer for Mars, just throwing that out there.
Give me the link. I'll sign up. I really relate to that sense of awe that Shasta feels about what lies north. And of course, we know the end of the story. We know it's because it's in his blood. We know that he's not supposed to be here. He wasn't made to be a fisherman's son.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing that really runs throughout the stories. And that desire for knowing, okay, the way it should be is I should have a father who is not even necessarily that. Well, I have to have a father that that is good to me. It's the idea the right thing is for me to have a father that I love, that I care very much about, knowing that that's the way that things should be. And then he's relieved when he finds out that that isn't his father, because it allows him to kind of think, oh, there's something else. There's something else that's actually attainable.
It explains something. Like you're saying, with being attainable, it's like he's had this feeling his entire life. I wasn't made for this place. I belong somewhere else. And now this legitimizes that. And he realizes this isn't just some vague feeling. Like, no wonder I've been feeling this way. It's because I wasn't actually born here. This isn't actually my real father.
Well, I like how his attitude, his kind of, he kind of has a lack of cynicism, because he doesn't really know enough to start to become too cynical.
Uh-huh.
And so I like how he doesn't expect Bree to start talking.
What a great scene. But I can.
Yeah. But he doesn't just flip out at it. Yeah,
In the Facebook group, Charlotte talked about how that scene gave her chills, and it is such a magical, it's a little contrived, of him saying out loud, I wish you could talk, old fellow, and yeah. Saying, but I can. It's a little contrived and I don't care. It's so, and part of it because it's like, I'm so, what is going on? Where am I? None of this feels familiar. And then finally, oh, talking horse from Narnia. Okay, so something I kind of recognize from the other books.
Yeah. Well, and it's to a certain extent, I was kind of thinking, okay, how realistic is it? Like, they just instantly, hey, you know, oh, you're a horse, I'm a boy. Let's just go, you know. But then to a certain extent, sometimes you think, you know, sometimes those spontaneous, crazy things, when you both have that window, you both want. And that you think, hey, this might actually work.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes you do go for it. So sometimes, in terms of like certain parts of the story that, you know, you read things differently as an adult. And I think, okay, on one hand, this is kind of contrived. And then on another hand, I think, yeah, but I don't know. You know, I think it was Mark Twain, I think, said the reason that truth is stranger than fiction is that fiction has to make sense. And I often think about that whenever I think, this would never happen, you know. And then there's, you know, real life things where you think, hey, you know, I don't know. It makes it easier for me to suspend disbelief sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I think it makes sense as far as them teaming up. It's both of them. Like, I'm sure Bree has been looking for an opportunity for years. And so he's like, oh, maybe this is my chance. And I'm sure Bree would be willing to risk his life if it doesn't work out. He's willing to give it a shot. And Shasta doesn't have a lot of time to figure it out. He's just got to take a leap right now. He can't wait until morning. He's got to either do it now or never. And he's been waiting. And he deep down has been waiting for this opportunity his whole life as well.
Right. Well, and I do like how you get a good view inside their thought process. I mean, more so Shasta, obviously, because you get to kind of see inside his head more.
Yeah.
But even Bree, you know, you have Bree when they're starting to travel together. Bree is terrified of, wait a second, what if I have all these dumb horse habits? Which is kind of, on one
like
hand,
rolling.
You think, yeah, like rolling in the grass. And you think, well, actually, I think if you were in his horseshoes. Sorry.
Oh,
I have no real sense of humor. I'm not actually really that funny, but then I say things that make myself laugh. And
he's
again,
not actually that
perfect.
Funny.
But if you were in his horseshoes, you'd think, wait, that actually kind of makes sense. Yeah, and it gives it kind of a sense of normalcy.
Yeah, because he was young. He was only a foal when he got kidnapped. Foal. Am I saying that right? Foal?
Mm-hmm. Foal.
Yeah, when he got kidnapped. And so he's grown up, and I think that makes perfect sense to worry that he's developed habits and won't fit in. And I think anyone can relate to that, to entering a new social group and wondering, am I doing it right? Am I doing it right? So it's that's a great example of it's a talking horse in a magical world, and a part of the magical world that I'm feeling alienated from and confused by and disoriented by. Oh, but there's something there that I recognize in the middle of this crazy world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I have to ask, this is one of those, I'm going to call them Andrew Adamson moments from now on, where we're going back to our memory of the books as kids. I have to ask, do you remember the first time you experienced, I think you were older when you first experienced the books than I was.
I was 12 or 13, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember your reaction with the, one of my favorite scenes in the book, which is the chase with the horses and the riders and the lions?
I remember being
spoiler
little,
alert.
Well, sorry. I think, yeah, I remember, spoilers, yeah, not for the last time. Are you still listening, Sam? You still listening? Okay. I remember wondering why they, it seemed weird that like the narrator or Bree or somebody didn't make some mention of Aslan when they hear lions. Mm-hmm. Like it just seems like it's certainly a narrator would say, I don't know what I would expect, but like this wasn't the lion Aslan or something like that. It's just, oh yeah, a lion. Mm-hmm. It's a weird thing to casual. Oh yeah. And there was a lion there as if it's not significant. Oh, it could have been any other animal. It happens to be a lion. And I kept wondering like, wait, is this Aslan? Well, I guess it's not, because wouldn't Aslan like talk to them or something or behave differently or mm-hmm. not just be roaring at them? I don't know. But I kept wondering, am I missing something? Am I supposed to be one? It just felt like there should be more of an acknowledgement that, hey, a lion right. character is an extremely significant lion in the first four books. Oh, yeah, and here's another lion. And that's another one where in the back of your head, almost like, am I reading the same book series right now? Am I in a totally different world or something? It makes you feel alienated. And then, of course, at the end, it all connects and it all makes sense. And that sense of alienation, just like Shasta feels, is critically important, I think, to the emotional core of the story.
I kind of buy it. I mean, just as a reader, thinking, okay, it's not Aslan, because you start thinking, oh, maybe this could be an author's technique to kind of throw you off. Like, oh, now in this land, there's all kinds of lions that aren't friendly and aren't talking beasts. And I remember, I think as a kid, thinking, oh, okay, lion equals Aslan, it's Narnia. Oh, okay, you know, you just assume. And then starting to think, oh, wait, oh, there's two of them. Oh, they're chasing them. Oh, well, Bree has encountered other lions in the past and he really hates them. Okay, I guess not. So I think I was pretty fully in the, oh, these actually real non-talking scary lions.
I mean, I'm not saying I didn't think it was Aslan. It just seemed like there should be some acknowledgement of the fact that, oh, yeah, the random lion showing up. And I guess I'm wondering, am I supposed to wonder if it's Aslan? Like, I don't know. It just seemed like almost a different book series to me to not even mention the fact that it's a lion, and there's a very prominent lion that is figured into all the first four books so far, and to just have just a random lion character felt really weird. Yeah. And I think that's really great that that Lewis does that and just throws you off.
Yeah. Well, and I really, it's one of the most stimulating scenes to my imagination really in the whole book series. Mm-hmm. I mean, just as I read it and I imagine it, I just love the image of it playing out, of the two riders on their horses, you know, looking completely different, one skilled, one unskilled, one in armor and one mm-hmm. not. You know, I just visually, I love the scene in the book.
It's one. It'll be hard favorites. To do in the movie with, you have to balance only using moonlight, and how do you depict something where it's supposed to be darkness and you can't see it? That's always really hard to do in movies. And yeah, I mean, this is kind of the iconic image of the book, I think, is the two horses. And
I think that it's just a great way to, it's a great way to, you know, and you find out later it is contrived, and it's not, you know, it's not contrived in a bad way, literally, or literarily in literature. Is that a word?
But it's like, yeah, but Aslan's contriving the whole thing.
It'd
be easy to say, oh my gosh, really, two talking horses just run into each other? What are the odds? And then you realize, oh, Aslan's been orchestrating the entire thing.
Yeah, it makes
from
a lot more sense.
End. So all the things along the way were kind of, that feels a little bit contrived. You realize, oh, but it was actually in-universe contrived.
Well, and I'm going to be honest here. It introduces two characters, one whom I don't care a whole lot about and one whom I love. I've always loved the character of Erebus. I always thought she was interesting. I thought she was unique. I thought she stood out in the story. I thought she was a very compelling character. And we get the character of Wynn, who's a, you know, a good character, but I don't know. I always feel like, I guess I felt like Wynn was kind of maybe given, kind of playing second fiddle.
I agree in that, if you look at, you know, Bree and Erebus and Shasta have More time is spent on them and they get more mm-hmm. nuance. But Huynh, I think the fact that she kind of gets a lot less attention is an important part of her character, because she's always in the background and she's easily put down, and other stories are kind of running to the forefront to get ahead of hers. And then at the end, Bree runs away from Aslan in terror, and she runs, you know, she walks up and says, you know, I'd rather be eaten by you than fed by anyone else. And that's the same thing happens to Shasta, of course. Shasta is the fisherman's son that Erebus totally mm-hmm. dismisses, and he becomes the hero of the book. And Bree is this arrogant warhorse, and he gets humbled at the end. So, mm-hmm. Although I agree with you, I think it for what Lewis was doing, having Huynh kind of be in the background actually makes sense for that character.
So, should the Tarkhan say to Arshish, this will not go the way you think.
This isn't going to end the way you expect or whatever.
What you're saying. I mean, I guess we'll come back to that later.
You've never seen any theories on Twitter like this before.
I'm going to be honest. Gasps. It's been a while since I have. It's just because of the movies and all the time we spent discussing the movies and even the commentary going through the books that were becoming movies and things. I've spent a lot more time in, say, Prince Caspian, Voyage of Don Treader, than I have Horse and His Boy mm-hmm. The last few years. So it's interesting, little things that I'm reading, I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember this now, you know?
Uh-huh. I like that it's just a little story that's not, I mean, it's the book out of the series that obviously would be easiest to cut. You could get rid of this one, and it doesn't affect, like, all the other six books mm-hmm. are much more close. You could connect them much more in a linear way. And then there's The Horse and His Boy. And I like that for all the reasons we said at the beginning, that it gives the world of Narnia the feeling of, like, without The Horse and His Boy, we wouldn't know what we were missing. But without it, the mm-hmm. world of Narnia, I don't think it would feel as real and as tangible, and it wouldn't feel like it has the depth of it does. Because it gives, well, like we said, it gives all those little stories. Oh my gosh, there must be a million stories.
Especially
like this.
After Voyage of the Dawn Treader, you have, Narnia is a country.
Yeah.
And you have little lands that are outside of Narnia. And then it makes sense here that you have, Narnia is a country, and to the south there are other countries.
Right.
And so I agree. We wouldn't really know what we were missing.
But we would be missing a lot.
Overall,
the world of Narnia would not feel as real if we didn't have mm-hmm. the horse and his boy to make us feel like, wow, that's just one little story that Lewis teased. There must be so many others.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love it. And it's, I mean, and of course, we're butting up to, you know, the next chapter. Chapter 3 has the actual story of Erebus.
Uh-huh. There's a couple.
We'll discuss next time.
I know we're going to end here soon. There's just a couple bits of humor at the end.
Mm-hmm.
That I love so much. I love when the four of them sit down together and Shasta says, and he tried to put on what he thought very grand and stiff manners, but as a fisherman's hut is not usually a good place for learning grand manners, the result was dreadful. Which again, I relate to that too, of, you know, trying to come across a certain way, but realizing, I wonder if they're on to me. And then of course,
note for the readers, I've met Glenpuddle's wife. She is very, very intelligent. Very smart. You have a very smart wife, sir. And so, is that so what you relate
she's
to?
She's on to me, basically. Is what you're okay. And then at the very, very end, Erebus starts telling her story, and it says, Erebus immediately began sitting quite still and using a rather different tone and a style from her usual one. For in Calormen, storytelling, whether the stories are true or made up, is a thing you're taught, just as English boys and girls are taught essay writing. The difference is that people want to hear the stories. Whereas I never heard of anyone who wanted to read the essays.
Yeah, and that, I thought that was funny too.
Yeah, another great narrator moment. The last one I'll mention, I just remembered, that I love about Shasta is the fact that he's eaten grass. There's a bit where, you know, Bree says something. I think he's waking up the next morning, and Bree's eating grass and says, you know, why can't you eat grass? And Shasta says, I can't eat grass. And Bree says, well, have you ever tried? And Shasta says, yes, I have. I couldn't get it down. And I just... And I don't know if maybe was it Shasta was 5 years old and he just, it could mean something funny like that, or it could be he was just bored and like, maybe I'll try grass, or maybe it was, you know, obviously they live in extreme poverty and maybe he really did just try. It could be a more serious thing. It could be he really tried grass because he was hungry. So I love I love the throwaway mention of the fact that he's tried grass with no explanation.
A little bit of my own history.
You tried grass.
I had this class in college at university, and where one of the people makes this comment, like, oh, man, it tastes like cardboard. And one of the women looks at him and goes, how do you know what cardboard tastes like? And the rest of the class just turns on her and goes, how do you not know what cardboard tastes like? And I just thought, oh, my goodness, I don't know who's the real idiot here. Because well, I know what cardboard tastes
like. Well, because of the smell, you know?
So you don't know what grass tastes like, Glumfiddle?
I mean, I've never tasted it before, but...
I do know what grass tastes like. I'm just telling you.
Oh, you've tried grass before? Okay.
I have.
What does it taste like?
No one is perfect.
So you can... So I mean, I've never tried grass, but I've tried... the Harry Potter every flavor grass flavored bean.
I say it
tastes like grass. I mean, I don't know if you tasted that bean. Can you tell me if that actually tastes like grass? I've always wanted to know.
I don't know. I haven't tasted the every flavor bean.
So I've tried the every flavor bean.
Because I never wanted to get earwax.
Okay. So you've tried the real thing.
I've tried the real grass.
This is a theme in Narnia. You've tried the real thing. I've tried the copy, the imitation.
I just tried
the Shadowlands grass, basically. You've tried the real thing.
Shadowlands grass. I finished The Horse and His Boy as a small child and went out and ate grass.
I mean, for me, what I got out of The Horse and His Boy was the themes of longing, the themes of, you know, C.S. Lewis said, if I find a longing in myself that nothing earthly can satisfy, then the most logical explanation is I was made for another world. And I connect with those themes, especially as I get older and I get slightly closer to death every day. And I wonder, is there anything else beyond this world? And what you get out of it was eat grass.
Eating grass, yes.
So, yeah.
But my theme was eat grass. No one's perfect.
Yep.
Okay. Let's
hear from somebody else.
Of Narnia. Let's hear from someone else who has not eaten grass, we hope.
All right, let's transition here to another edition of our new segment, Voices of Narnia Web. We'll be right back.
Voices of Narnia Web.
My name is Sarah Reese, and I'm from Richmond, Virginia. And I've loved Narnia almost as long as I can remember. My dad first introduced me to the books when I was... really a toddler, and I rediscovered them for myself when I was in my early teens and just have loved the rich imagery, the way the stories have really captured my imagination. And when I was a teenager, I used to love drawing, and I used to draw scenes that I imagined as kind of continuations of the story. So just scenes that were sort of alluded to within the books, I would try to illustrate what those scenes could be like, because Lewis is just so good at providing the landscape of Narnia and then giving you kind of a jumping off point to imagine further episodes and further stories. But some of my Narnia highlights in my life have been going to the Eagle and Child pub in Oxford, England. That happened last year. And a number of years ago, I got to go to the Marion Wade Center and look at the wardrobe and just enjoy seeing that. And so we love celebrating Narnia in our house through parties, through dress up, through feasts, and through the books and through art on our walls. And these stories have so enriched our lives and surround us in our home. So... we love Narnia a lot.
If you want to share what the Chronicles of Narnia means to you, send your voice to the email address in the episode description.
This is your C.S. Lewis Minute. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. Previously, I gave you an overview of Lewis's science fiction series. This time, here's more about the first of those three books, Out of the Silent Planet. As noted before, Elwyn Ransom is in each of the books. He's the main character in Out of the Silent Planet, as well as the second book. In this first title, he's an unwilling guest on an adventure to Mars. He's taken there by two other men because they believe a human sacrifice is needed to appease the unseen ruler. Ransom manages to escape, but he's trapped on a planet with no way to get home. Did I mention that he is a philologist, like Lewis's friend, the real-life J.R.R. Tolkien? As you might imagine, this skill helps him to learn how to talk to the various creatures on Mars. But will it be enough to get him home? Read Out of the Silent Planet to find out. Learn more about the creator of Narnia at my website, EssentialCSLewis.com.
And we're back with...
Let's do it.
The Stump Question. If you recall, the question was, which of the following descriptions was used to describe the leaves from the toffee tree in The Magician's Nephew? A, crimson. B, papery. C, shimmering. D, smooth.
This is the toffee tree?
The toffee tree.
The toffee tree.
Do you remember where the toffee tree was?
Well, yeah, I remember when Polly and... Okay. Polly and Diggory, yeah, they plant the leftover toffee and it grows up into a tree.
Mm-hmm.
But what was it like? I seem to recall. Boy, I love that scene. That's the scene where they think they hear the witch at night, mm-hmm. and it's really, really creepy. But how do they describe the top? I'm trying to stall and give the listener a chance to think about it. But I'm trying to do it really, subtly.
Good
though.
One.
I don't want them to know that I'm stalling. So make sure we cut this out of the edit. Make sure they don't know that I'm just trying to stall. The only one I can think of is the one that sounds familiar to me is papery, or maybe crimson, but somehow papery is ringing a bell, so I'm going to go with B, papery, final answer.
That is your final answer?
That's my final answer.
The answer is B, papery.
Boom.
Specifically whitish and rather papery.
Okay, yeah. Rydian was really worried if that was too... She couldn't decide if that was too hard or too easy. And that one...
See the first page of chapter 13, the second paragraph of The Magician's Nephew.
Once again, if you think... Yes, you, the listener. If you think you can stump a Narniweber, which will probably be either me or Rillian, submit trivia questions to podcast@narniweb.com with stump as the subject. I think we're done. You want to try reading the outro again? I think it's a little bit better.
Outro. Okay.
Obi, and he takes a sip of water. This is a big deal. The new and improved Talking Beast outro. I spent like 30 seconds improving this.
Hey, no one is perfect. You've been listening to Narnia.
And mind. You messed it up on the first try!
I screwed it up! You've been listening to Talking Beasts, a NarniaWeb.com podcast. Be sure to subscribe and post a comment below or in the Talking Beasts Facebook group. You can also email us at podcast@narniaweb.com, rillian@narniaweb.com, or glumpuddle@narniaweb.com. Look for new episodes every other Tuesday. Until next time, further up and further in.